where to start introducing our speaker tonight? I've known him a whole life. He's become a role model in my life about how to give back and to work this program, to do it every day and stay sober for the 24 hours. And he does that daily. He's found the Al-Anon group because of me and the sobriety. So he works two different programs, and he gives back to the USO and all kinds of different organizations. My dad, Steve Presser.
Good evening, everybody. My name is Steve, and I am an alcoholic.
Hey, Steve.
I figure there's enough people in here who know me that y'all could actually just exchange notes, and I can go sit down, and then that way I don't have to stand up here and tell my story. But anyway, I'll just start out with the beginning of my life. I was raised in a very small farming community in southeastern Missouri. It was a small town. It was a farming community, and my father had the local drugstore. And as time went on, not from my childhood on, the population started to leave because farm machinery started coming in and taking over the jobs of the farm workers and the sharecroppers. And so all was left were actually the farmers who owned the land. And so it was kind of like, I don't know, some of y'all maybe remember the movie The Last Picture Show. That picture show in the movie, that last picture show, they were shutting down the theater because there was nobody left in the town to keep it open. And that's what happened in the town I grew up in. The picture show in my town shut down. I was like 35 people in my class, and I knew from a very early age that I was different, and I didn't understand why, but I just felt like I was different. I felt like that I did not belong in that small community like that. My father was particularly difficult. He would get on to me for every little thing that I did, and I could not do anything right. And he was constantly on me to this and do that. And so I kind of grew with him because I had no self-confidence. I felt like I didn't have the ability to be around friends or be friends with people. I used to wish that other people were my parents, because my parents, I don't know, there's this turmoil in my house. But that being said, we had no liquor in the house, no alcohol was allowed, and we went to church three times a week, Sunday morning, Sunday evening, and Wednesday night. And and it was in that small community like that, everybody knew everybody else's business, so there was no place really to hide. Well, I remember here in the sixth grade someone telling me about getting an education. If you get your education, that's something nobody else could take away from you. So I dreamed about getting out of high school and going to college and getting away from that, and I especially getting away from my father. I had strong dislikes for him. It was really more like hatred, I guess you could say, than anything else. But I'll get back to him later. In any event, as soon as I got out of high school, I did go to school, college. I went to a small community college my first 2 years, where it was a work program where you worked and you went to classes and you worked. So it was I worked my way through my first year, 2 years of college doing that. Then I went to a big university. To me, it was really big anyway, and there. I began to open up more. I began to become more aware that I had confidence In fact, I did that in a junior college too. I could have confidence, self-confidence, and I could do things that I didn't think I could do. And I became involved in different organizations and different things like that. And suddenly a light came on my life that there was sunshine out there. It wasn't all dark, you know. So I did not drink, though, when I got away from home. We used to, in high school, I did imbibe a few times. Like we would get a six-pack of Blue Ribbon, Pabst Blue Ribbon, and we'd go out on the ditch bank. We didn't have any streams. We called them ditches. And we would drink and then throw the beer cans in the ditch. And I would like to take maybe just a few sips because I didn't even like the taste of beer. So I didn't really have a problem with wanting to pick up a drink. Now, again, in college, I did pick up a drink every once in a while, but never. It was always beer, nothing hard liquor. So that being said, I went in college, and when I went to the University of Arkansas, I got a job in the summer at selling books door to door, and this required a lot of discipline. I remember that, and we worked about 80 hours per week, and I made enough money in the summertime to pay my way through college. So I ended up paying practically all of my college expenses. I paid for myself. And again, my college years were very nice, and I had a lot of friends, and I began to expand my social horizons, you know, so I wasn't near the kind of person I was, and I really did blossom out a lot. So I finished school, and I went back, actually I applied for law school and got accepted to law school. However, there was a war going on, and so that war was the war in Vietnam, and like all naive college students, I got drafted and right out of college, and so I was in boot camp just a few months after I got my college diploma. And I remember going through boot camp, and I didn't really catch on to what was going on with the war too much at that time, because I had no intentions of going to Vietnam anyway, I was going to become a medic and become a hospital orderly, and the most dangerous thing I would do would be changing bedpans in hospitals, and that was actually what I thought I would be doing, you know. Anyway, lo and behold, they gave orders when I went to boot camp and I went to medical corps training, and the orders, when they called them out, my name was on the list to go to Vietnam. And that was a complete surprise to me, because I thought that I didn't think they would want me to be in Vietnam. I wasn't a soldier type person. I had grown up with John Wayne movies, and I didn't fit the picture, I didn't think. But that's how, you know, I was just naive. And so that being said, I remember also that they offered me to go to OCS, but I turned it down because I heard that they were going to send me to infantry OCS. Someone told me that the life expectancy of a second lieutenant in Vietnam was like 30 minutes. And so I thought, well, I won't be going to the OCS, you know. But anyway, I did get drafted, and I was sent to Vietnam. I remember getting off that plane. It was in 1968, and it was 3 days after the Tet Offensive. And it was at Benwell Airport, and it had been literally burned down. All that was left was the airstrip. We landed, no buildings around, nothing. We landed, and then I got off the plane, and there was a long lot of soldiers getting ready to get back on the plane that I had just gotten off of. And I looked at them with such envy. I remember that. I remember the stench I smelled, you know. So they sent me to a base camp, and from there they sent me out into the field, as a platoon medic. And I had been there maybe 3 or 4 weeks. We had a few skirmishes, and I remember myself becoming very hardened to the things that were around me. I mean, I learned to speak up for myself, and then the naive attitude that I had, you know, it quickly left because I knew that this was not Sunday school. This was not playtime. You know, this was real. So I just did my job. I remember being a Boy Scout, and Boy Scouts, you be prepared. So I was prepared. I had my medical bag all ready, ready to go anytime something happened. And I was a platoon medic, then I was a company medic, and then I was a battalion medic, just before I left. And along the way, of course, I saw a lot of different things happen, and my best friend was killed. And I remember I was out in the field. I was sent out to the field to replace him, and I didn't know that he'd been killed. And when I got there, the guys told me that he was shot between the eyes. He never knew what hit him. And they pointed to this place over there where he had died. And it wouldn't be just I was trying to process that. It wouldn't have been a few minutes later that we started receiving incoming fire. And I remember getting behind a tree, and I was never so scared as I was at that time. I sit behind the tree, my teeth chattered, I couldn't stop them, and I was praying that there wouldn't be any casualties that day because I just couldn't handle it. And fortunately, we didn't. It didn't last very long. But I remember that day because that was the first and the last time that I shook like that. But I did that. I remember that particular day. It was the most frightening experience I'd ever had. And I didn't really understand it for a long time. In fact, for years later, before I understood why I was so frightened at that time. But anyway, I got through Vietnam and came home. And I went back to where my parents lived, and I wasn't going to live there. I just went back to visit, and my father, who had been downtrodden me all those years about not being, you know, having anything to me, suddenly became quite interested in me, and he wanted to parade me around in front of his friends and me wear my dress greens with my medals so he could parade me around. And I felt so embarrassed over that. And I was also very, very angry because, you know, here I was, I'd made something to him out of myself, and he was practically proud of me. But he showed me around like I was a trophy. And, you know, I didn't really care to that too much. So I got out of there as soon as possible. I got out of there, and I moved to Atlanta. And I went to a church here in Atlanta, and at church, not too long after I met here, had moved here, I met my first wife, and we courted for about 6 months or so, and decided we would get married. And she represented to me all the things that would settle me down, that give me roots, you know, because I had no roots. I just need to establish roots somewhere. I need to find somewhere to land. And I stuffed all that stuff from my past. I just stuffed it away and said, you know, I'm not going to be that. I'm not going through that anymore. I'll just forget about it. And that's literally what I did. I wiped everything off the map and went on and did that. But when I did that, of course. Oh, by the way, I left out an important detail. In Vietnam is where I started drinking, and I drank. Little slight little detail there that I forgot about. But I did drink in Vietnam. I remember going back to the rear, and I started drinking. I didn't stop until I was drunk, and it felt really good. And I remember saying to myself, you know, this is going to help me get through here. So there was no liquor allowed out on the field, but when I went back to the rear, I would go back there and I would get drunk every time. But I thought that, you know, this will last only over here and it'll be gone. But, and there were drugs around in Vietnam, as we all heard about, a lot of drugs going on. And I had a medical bag full of drugs. I had morphine, I had Libriums, I had Darvons, I had Valium, I had anything a good drug addict would want to have, you know, but I never even knew they were addictive. I did shoot morphine to patients. I gave Libriums out sometimes to guys, but it never occurred to me that these things could get you in a lot of trouble. But I did discover alcohol. I definitely did that. Well, I got back, and as I said, I got... met my bride and we got married, and I thought that the drinking was behind me. I know we made a pact that we have nothing but wine in the house. Well, that didn't last very long for me. I could not stop the drinking, and so I continued on. And during this period of time, we had two children. I have my daughter Stephanie. He's here. And of course, you met Todd, and we went to church, had the atmosphere of having a happy home. Fortunately enough, we were living in a cul-de-sac with a nice house, and when the children came, my wife didn't work; she stayed home as a housewife, and I was the one who went out and brought home the bacon. Anyway, I would make stops on the way home. And they got to be more and more frequent. You know, I would find a crowd to go with to bar for a happy hour. And we didn't have liquor in the house. I didn't bring any into the house, but I certainly, at first, I didn't bring. I just went to the bar and drank. But then, after a while, I started buying liquor at the liquor store. And my first, I think it was gin. I started out with gin. And I would buy gin and drive around and drink, which that was real smart. And as a result, I got three DUIs. And actually, one thing happened during that period of time, though, I didn't get arrested for, but should have. And that was when Todd and I, he was only about 3 or 4 years old, we had been to I guess it was a Walt Disney movie anyway, and I had the urge to drink, and I just didn't know what to do, so I went to a 7-Eleven store, and I bought Todd a Coke or something, and I got a bottle of wine, and I proceeded to drink the wine, and then we would drive around the neighborhood, you know. And after, I don't know how long I drove around, but anyway, we got picked up at the blue lights behind me. And cop got out and said a concerned citizen called me and told me that there's a drunk guy running around weaving all over the road. And it was at you, isn't it? Of course, no, I mean, there's no way out of it. He saw me. And, you know, because Tom was in the car with me, he said, I'll give you an option here. If you can call your wife and she can come over and pick y'all up, then I'll let you go. But if she does not answer the phone, you're going to jail and your son is going to Child Protective Services. Well, fortunately, she did answer the phone and she came over and she picked us up, and I went back home, and I did not get charged for that. But I did get charged, and the third DUI I had is when I decided I needed to move out of the house because I was making the house miserable with my coming and going. I mean, I would, there's many times when I'd come home late at night, and everybody would be in bed, and there would be dinner on the table, cold, of course, but, you know, I wasn't there to eat on time. And I got to isolating in a guest bedroom and wouldn't come out. And I knew that something was very wrong with me. I had no idea what it was. I didn't even call myself an alcoholic because I didn't know what an alcoholic was. And that's the truth, believe it or not. So continued on until the third one. I came home after I came home that morning from the third DUI. I moved out, and that was a very, you know, difficult day. It was very, of course, it was one of the saddest days of my life. Here I had all the things growing up as a son, as a child, living in that small town. I mean, moving to the big city and being in, and I was in the financial services, and I had a prosperous career. I mean, this is something a young man would dream about, but I couldn't live it. I could not live that environment, and I had to get out, and so I did. And I know we went through marriage counseling, but it really didn't work. I just couldn't see myself being married, and so. We got a divorce, and then I moved into a party complex. I knew about where party complexes were in Buckhead, and so I continued to drink and drink like I wanted to drink. I never got another DUI because I learned something. Don't drink and drive. But I didn't keep me from having somebody else to drive me around. I always had somebody to drive so that I would not get another DUI. And I didn't, because I learned the lesson. I wasn't about to start drinking. Heavens no. You know, I was fully, and that was my love was the alcohol. And so I was definitely gonna have like a drink. You know, a few years went by, and I know that when I got the divorce, my attorney told me I could never afford the alimony and child support. And I told him, you know, well, I'll just have to do better in my career. And I did. I did. I made enough money that I was able to keep up the commitments. I realized that maybe only two things I had at that time was my career and my two children. And I did not want to see them, their lifestyle have to go downhill because of me. And so I did. I did make the obligations of my, according to my divorce, and I did that. And also, I became involved in my alumni association. I became involved with my civic organization and a professional organization. And in my professional organization, I had all the designations it took to be in the financial services business. I was crystal clean on the outside. I dressed well. I looked good on the outside. I made sure that I had a very carefully groomed image out there. And I was on the board of directors of this and that, president of this and that. You know, I was in who's who. I was a golden, I guess you call it golden child back in the 80s. That's the image that I wanted to have, but yet I had my party bunch that I went out with and let my hair down, this is the image that I cultivated. And I know I took people out to dinner a lot and to plays and ball games, and we would drink. And I would, you know, do like a social person would drink socially. And that I hated to do that. I hated drinking socially, but I did it because of my career. But when I got home, I mean, that's when I got the really solid drinking, because I had to be drunk every night, because I couldn't go to bed without being drunk. And then I met my current wife a few years later, and we dated off and on for several years because I wasn't in a mood to get married again. I didn't think marriage was cut out for me. My first marriage was such a disaster that I didn't want to repeat that. So I didn't, but in fact, she was a single mother with two children, and she was having trouble with them. My God, I had enough without having to get involved with her children. But anyway, after they left, we did become more involved, and we ended up getting married. And this was in 1994, and we had an alcoholic marriage. I mean, I was the alcoholic, but she knew that I wanted to drink, and she never tried to stop me. And I know at the time there were other ones around me that were concerned in my family about my drinking, but I didn't know it. I didn't pay attention to it. I didn't want to know. all I knew was that I wanted to drink, and I didn't want anybody to interfere with my drinking. And so my wife made sure that she didn't interfere with my drinking. And so this went on for quite a few years, and during that period of time, we were able to do a lot of nice things together. We went on several trips, some of which I remember, some I don't. But we did. I got drunk in some of the finest hotels in Europe and all this, you know. So I was, I was living a life that I thought I could handle, but in the early 90s, things got out of control, started getting out of control, and I didn't really pay any attention to it at first. But as the years went on, the 90s were hell for me because the what I call the Midas touch, whatever I had, I didn't have it any longer. I remember getting out with the presentations that I would have. Used to get up and do a presentation and do fine with it. No one ever knew that I'd been out drinking the night before. When you're young, you can do those things. But my system got to where they couldn't take it any longer. And I started forgetting things on appointments. And I would not be drunk either. I'd be sober, but I couldn't remember. And I have to tell them I get back to them. Once, I even went out to an appointment, got way out somewhere, an office park, opened a briefcase up, and my presentation wasn't in there. I had forgotten my presentation. These things started happening to me, and so I was on a straight commission all these years. So things started getting bad, and I couldn't understand why. I did not know how to do anything else, and so I knew I had to stick with this, and I thought I keep on working hard enough and long enough that I'll work myself out of this and I'll be all right. And I never once thought that drinking had anything to do with it. So I kept on drinking, and my sales plummeted. And I remember the last year I was in that business, I made about one-fifth of what I had made when I was doing really well. And that was humiliating. It was humiliating to me because some of these fellows I had been working with all through my career, and I had done better than a lot of them had for many years, and they were all doing better as time went along. I was going the other way. And that was quite humiliating. And so I didn't want to let my lifestyle change because I couldn't afford what I used to could afford, so I started running into a lot of debts, bills, and getting in trouble with the IRS and fun things like that. So as time went along, I found it very difficult to go to work and do anything. I mean, I would sit there in my office, put papers back and forth, and I couldn't do anything worthwhile. And that was in 1999 when I got to the low point. Anyway, my wife and I had planned a trip to Paris, and she had no idea. I didn't have any idea. I kept all this financial stuff away from her, and she didn't really know how bad off I was because we had separate checking accounts, and so she never saw my checkbook. Anyway, we went on the trip, and on that trip, before that trip, we took that trip in October of 1999. Before we went on that trip, I knew that I was at the rope's end because I had done one thing that I was going to have to answer for. Never once did I play with any money in my career for my clients. I know there's been scandals in the financial service industry, and it's still there, but that happens. But I didn't do that, but I did something really bad. And I could tell this in public because I've already admitted it right away, and that is I was custodian for a charitable foundation account in the organization I belonged in, and these people trusted me, and I was the one who wrote the checks out of the account. Well, during this time, this is when I was really sick up here, the insanity of the disease is catching up with me. Because I started funneling that money into my own account. And I was doing that, you know, when we were getting ready to go to Paris. I had absolutely no business whatsoever doing that But my wife was looking forward to it. I didn't want to disappoint her, and I was just kind of caught up in a chaos. And my mind, I was really chaotic at that time because this addiction has really gotten to me. So I didn't think that was wrong. I didn't think it was wrong. I thought that I would, you know, just borrow the money, and this big sale was going to come through. And I was going to put it all back, and no one would ever know, because I only had made accounting at the end of the year. That's the only time I had to make accounting for the money, and I was going to have it back in there, and no one ever looked at the books. Well, I knew pretty much that when we went on that trip that I couldn't afford it, so I was going to do what to me was a logical thing for me to do. I mean, this is the way I thought. The logical thing for me to do would be to kill myself, because if I killed myself, then I had a huge life insurance policy, and it would pay off all my debts, leave money for my family, and also I would have it funneled right back into that custodian account that I was and put it right back in that account. I had it all paperwork out that there would be money to go right back into that account. They would know it, of course, that I had taken it, but it'd be back in there. So anyway, I couldn't pay it back. So that's what I think was the final trigger. So when we came back, I started making plans to do away with myself. And at those last month or so, before the end of the year, I just went to the office and acted like I was working. I picked up the phone, did a few bit of service work and stuff like that. Didn't attempt to make any sales. But I was plotting. Well, the day I picked was December 28th. It was after Christmas, and it was before New Year's. And I remember my wife and I had my daughter and my son over there for Christmas dinner. And I guess they knew anything wrong, but I remember hugging them very tightly that night, because that was the last time they were going to see me alive. So I did that, and I went into my plans, and I had everything laid out. What I did was I went and rented a hotel room, and I left all the notes on my dining room table for my wife, and I had notes written to everybody, all my my family, my children, my mother, explained to them that this is the way I looked at it. It was something really deep, dark inside of me that I could never fight. I've been cursed by the devil. That's what I looked at it. I've been cursed by the devil, and there's nothing that I can do, you know, and I don't know how to live. And that's it. I didn't know how to live. Everything that I thought valued my life was gone, and I was humiliated, and I had been stripped of integrity, and that's what the disease does to you, and I didn't even know that. So we went ahead with my plans, and I had all this stuff anyway, I went to the hotel room and took all my pills with me. I was never, by the way, I never was addicted to painkillers, but I had painkillers in the house because I had back problems, and I only took those as prescribed too. But I had back problems, and I had anything I could find. I went into the hotel room, and I filled the bathtub up with water, put on my bathing suit because I didn't want to be found naked, and. And I proceeded to take all these pills, and I had a drink of scotch like you've never seen before. I mean, it was like this huge, big gulp. And I was relaxing, sitting back in the bathtub, and I filled it up. And the reason I did that, well, you know, in case these pills and this liquor doesn't kill me, then I'll pass out and drown. And I had heard people, you know, doing that before, that drunks, you know, I had heard that they do that. Drunks pass out and drown, and I had heard that before, so that's the reason I said that, you know. So I did that, and I don't know what happened, but I did leave a message on my wife to call 911 and tell her not to come to the hotel, and it was retail. She was during the holidays, and she was working 9:30, 10 o'clock at night. I don't have any idea what she got home, but she did get home, and she called 911, and they came and got me at the hotel room, and I vaguely remember, I just remember them putting on a stretcher, me on a stretcher, and they tied me down, and I was fighting, trying to get out of there. I'm sure I was just wild. I didn't really know what was going on at that time, because I really was out of it. So they put me back, and they put charcoal down me, forced it down my throat, and I've never thrown up so much in my life, you know. But I did all that night. I was in ICU for one night, and they figured I was going to live. So they put me, locked me up, and with no key, and put me on a suicide watch. And so I decided that there was me and possibly one other person in that room there, that facility that I was in, were sane. Everybody else was crazy. And I think, you know, that's it. But because this one woman, she could talk like she had some sense in her head, you know. And I thought, well, you know, I can talk to her. And that's what I thought. I thought I and possibly one other person, the only two sane people in that locked up. And then and another thing happened, I thought, and I didn't think about this until years later. I mean, not years later, but sometime later. I happen to remember a few months before I tried to do this, my next door neighbor, she shot and killed herself on her father's grave. She left behind a husband and a teenage son. And I remember how all the people in the neighborhood were upset, you know, because she was a kind woman and she had did a lot for neighbors, went to her funeral, and then it was a packed house. And then she had killed herself. Why would somebody who had all those, you know, and she had something wrong with her, that she had been depressed for years, but something was wrong with her, you know? And I had compassion for that woman, but when I looked at it, for me, I had no idea anybody would have any compassion for me. My feelings had disappeared. All I wanted to do was disappear. I wanted peace in my life, and that peace was death. I had no understanding that anybody would be upset whatsoever, because, you know, I was going to give them this, I thought, was a gift at my death, and everybody would live along and have a happy life. And that's exactly the way I thought. Anyway, I say this, and when I was locked up in there, I was off there during the new millennium. I got to see the new millennium in locked up, and saw about 15 different countries. But the year 2000 came, and I was still in there. January the 1st, 2000, my daughter came to see me, and she had gotten engaged the night before on New Year's Eve. She showed me her engagement ring, and we were talking, and I could see pain in her face. And suddenly I stopped and I said, "Stephanie, I've hurt you, haven't I?" And she said, "Yes, Dad, you have." And with that, I started crying, and she held me in her arms. Well, I cried. Up until then, I didn't have any idea anybody would miss me. You know, I began to have the feelings. That was the first sign of feelings that came back to me. It was whenever I did that, and I did I told myself that I had to do something. I had to do something to get myself together. My personal physician recommended he recommended two places, and I came to Ridgeview. I came here, and I was giving lip service about the first 3 days here. I did not know how to tell the truth. I did not know how to do anything but be suave and sophisticated and talk about things like I was, you know, somebody. And, you know, I was just an old drunk, and I did not know that I was just an old garden variety drunk. I didn't even get into drugs, which cost a lot more money. And I even, you know, I would even drink cheap liquor. So I was just a drunk. And, you know, they finally convinced me of that, you know, that, you know, so I began to say that I was an alcoholic. I learned how to say that. When I learned how to say that, I learned to get honest, and I took this leap of faith while I was here, because I had been, after a while, I understood that I was in a place where I felt safe, and people were here were like me. Here I was in a locked up, not we're you know, we're not locked up here, but you know, here we are, screwed up people, and I felt right at home. Because, you know, I had never been around people like me before. And so I took that leap of faith, and I started learning what the steps were all about. And from taking that leap of faith and turning it all over to God, you know, I tried to do that the best I could. Then I began to understand the spirituality of the program. The spirituality of this program has saved me. That's the first thing I think I got to that program that really saved me. And so I became very much involved with my recovery. And I came out here and I volunteered out here for several years, off and on, doing things. I still come out here. I'm out here every other weekend working in meetings, and I sponsor quite a few people. And that helps me keep sober too. So once I got into this program, I soaked it up like a sponge. It was something that I could grab a hold of and stick to. I mean, I could just feel it. And I never had that feeling before, you know, and it brings me back. And one thing I did is I remembered to go back and look for that little boy that I used to be, that young boy that I used to be before I got all caught up in the war and in the business world I was in. And I began to like that young man that I used to know. And thank God I found him. So I'm much more comfortable being that simple little boy than I ever was being an executive. And life has been really good to me. The promises have been really great for me. I remember after a year of sobriety, a little over a year, I was watching Tom Brokaw doing a special with the Pearl Harbor, the guys who, the survivors of Pearl Harbor. These are soldiers, of course. They were way up in their years then. And they were talking about their friends and talking about them and describing them, and it was like it just happened yesterday for them, and they were talking about that, and I listened to that, and they started, you know, they got emotional, started crying, and I did too. I cried, and I'd never cried before like that, and I had these big ugly tears, and that went on for some time. It went on for about almost 2 weeks because I couldn't tell anybody. I didn't know what was wrong with me. So one day I came out here to aftercare, and I don't remember anything that went on that meeting, except I remember when I was sharing, Sam stopped me. He told me, "Steve, you need help outside of the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous," because I was talking about the grief I had. And the blame and the guilt I have from that war, you know. He referred me to a man named Paul, sitting back there. Paul is a therapist. He is a Vietnam veteran, and he's one of us. But he's a Vietnam veteran. After talking to Paul, I guess for maybe 10 minutes one day, I realized that he knew what was going on inside my brain, you know. And I have what we call post-traumatic stress disorder. I had carried it around with me all those years. And it's inherited PTSD. And I don't know, as Paul told me, somebody told me, says, "Steve, you were wounded over there, but you were hit with a psych bullet. And that psych bullet is just as damaging as a real bullet." And I began to understand then more about why I had all this dark, horrible feelings that I couldn't identify with. I shoved it all back in my mind. And when being sober, my mind started clearing, and after a year of that, the things started coming back to me. And so I went into therapy. I was with Paul, had a group of men that he worked with, and I was in his group. And I remember I wrote letters to my father, and I made peace with my father, thank God. I realized that my father gave me all that he could give. He came from a dysfunctional family, and I've forgiven him. And he was deceased long before I got sober, but I made peace with him, and that's one of the best things I've done since I've been sober in my own heart. And I've been to his grave, and anyway, I told him I loved him, and it freed me of a lot of stuff. It did. That being said, I started becoming involved with the Vietnam veterans. I work with them now, and I do volunteer work with veterans. I belong to an organization of Vietnam veterans who are promoting the good side of Vietnam. That's all the veterans that come back, alcoholic and drunks and tramps and homeless and all this stuff that you heard about the veterans. And it's done a lot for me. It's helped me. It's been good therapy for me to be in that group. And I'm really proud and honored to be in that group. I'm real proud and honored to serve with the soldiers who come to the airport. I go and greet them now. And I know that I'm a soldier. And I know that my soldier, being a soldier, and other Vietnam veterans in this room, what we did to us was just as important as what they did in World War II. We just happened to be in an unpopular place, wrong place at the wrong time, and our country wasn't ready for what we went through. But I've become proud because I never thought of myself as a soldier before, and it's going to be dedicated to working with other veterans, not just Vietnam veterans, but other veterans, all wars. And I take a lot of pride, and that gives me a lot of happiness, just really happiness to be able to do that. And I'm so glad that I'm in the situation I am now. One other thing or two, and I'll shut up. About 2 or 3 years ago, I have a son who y'all know here, Todd, and I was talking about him in meetings, and so Sam, one of them, told me, "Steve, you need to be an Al-Anon." And I thought, well, you know, I don't belong in Al-Anon, you know. And my sponsor, who couldn't be here this evening, he's ill. My A sponsor's ill this evening. He couldn't be here. But he told me to get an Al-Anon. So that's the way it happens with me. Somebody has to literally beat me over the head before I get through. So I went to Al-Anon. And Al-Anon, I learned a whole different side of me. And I might have an Al-Anon sponsor who's here this evening, Reed. And he's been a tremendous amount of help to me, and I have learned to take care of myself, help me to set new boundaries with myself. I don't know if it did any good for him or not, but I know it's been did good for me. And I went into with Alan off the idea that they're going to talk about me because, you know, but I learned more about the elephant in the room. I learned what it does to families of alcoholics. And what we do to them when we are the elephant in the room, and how we dance around the elephant. And I learned how crushed people have been, and what do you call it? Anyway, abused, that's it. Abused that we put on our family members without even realizing it. And that's been a big blessing for me. To be able to see that part of the alcoholic that I couldn't see before. And I just close with step 12. Service work, that keeps me alive, it keeps me going. I love working with sponsees. I have several sponsees I work with. They keep me sober. And coming back out here, I mean, every time I come back out here and get in Bridgeview, I feel like I'm home again. And I have this real warm feeling for this place. and I'm sure I will for the rest of my life, because what I learned here and what I learned outside in AA rooms, I learned something about living, the simple living, and learning how to smell the roses that I never, ever would have ever thought of knowing had I not gotten to this program. And I feel so fortunate, so very blessed, and the promises have been so come true to me to have been a part of this program and being a part of you wonderful people here tonight. Thank you.
That was cool. You know, like, he was carrying around that bag full of morphine and those good drugs, and I just don't understand why he didn't want to try them. You know, it's just a different age now. I mean, that bag would have been gone before I even stepped on the field. But thanks, Dad. That was awesome.